I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe art historian Sharon Udall. Her new book is called Dance and American Art, A Long Embrace. And tonight at 6 o'clock, she will be at Collected Works Bookstore in conversation with former dancer Catherine Oppenheimer. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Delighted. Thanks.
So how did you get into this whole subject of dance as it's represented in art in this country?
It grew out of a lot of years of teaching art history and humanities, where I would look at American and European art and just see occasional forays by painters, sculptors, photographers, printmakers into subjects of the dance. And I thought, now why was this artist interested in dance? And I'd explore that a little bit. And finally, after doing it many, many times, I thought, well, there's material here. This might make an interesting study.
And one of the things that's interesting is that it's not like a painter painting a landscape or a sunset or a forest or whatever. It's there's a relationship. When an artist is working with a dancer to paint or sculpt them or whatever, that's a human being who is inspiring them, and often there's a real mutual relationship.
There was. Sometimes it was a personal relationship, an acquaintance, even a love affair. But at other times, it was merely being caught up in the act of performance. And that's what made it so tricky, I think, for a lot of these artists. They were drawn to try to fix something about the motion of the dance. But imagine how hard that had to be. How do you capture that moment of expressive movement?
Well, it's very hard, and it's almost hubristic to do it, because dance is inherently about motion, and then they're trying to fix it in a point in time. And honestly, even in photography, not very many people do it all that well.
Exactly right. To capture that characteristic moment or that particular gesture, there are a lot of things in between that aren't as meaningful, but to actually grasp that significant moment.
And so they do it anyway, and the history in American art goes way back. You have surprisingly 16th century representations of dance in your book. What are those about?
Yes, painted later. Well, certain artists in the Hudson River School, for example, Asher B. Durand, was interested in the early history of the American colonies and his Knickerbocker tales that were so widely read at that point. He decided to reconstruct some scenes from that. And one of them involves a very lively dance on the Bowery in New York. So it's a 1600s subject that he's painting in the 1800s. Some of the very earliest examples are watercolors and drawings that were made by people who came over on one of the early expeditionary ships landing in Virginia. And one of the first things they saw were Native American ceremonials that involved a certain kind of dance. It's a ritual drama performance, but they put it down as a subject of individuals dancing, and it had some meaning, it had some spiritual significance. They may not have understood it, but it went down in the record, and these are marvelous, lively watercolors.
One thing that's interesting is that on some level, when artists and some of the people represented in this book are making drawings or paintings or whatever of a completely different culture, it tends to look like their own culture. So these pictures of Native Americans dancing look awfully kind of courtly European in a funny way.
They do. Good point. Yes, they try to arrange them in some way or capture a moment that would look vaguely familiar so that the viewer of the painting might be able to figure out or relate in some way to what's going on.
Right. Now, to what extent were people dancing, not in performance, but socially, in the colonies in the early history of the United States?
Oh, it's a mixed bag. In some places it was widely done. In the South, for example, there were lots of French dancing masters who were brought over to Charleston and places like that. In New England, there was the whole Puritan ethic that really stood in the way of social dancing or performance for a long, long time. There were efforts made to close theaters, and young people especially were discouraged at the peril of losing their souls from engaging in dancing of any kind or watching it.
And so that Puritanism led to revolts against Puritanism in dance later in our history.
They did indeed, very prominently in the work of some people such as Isadora Duncan, for example, and Martha Graham, who were both very conscious of this Puritan heritage that America had. And the decision made in the early 20th century, there were some efforts before, but in the early 20th century to combat that, to say we're going to overthrow that rigid sort of straight-laced Puritan ethic that has kept dance out of the minds and out of the view of so many people.
And of course it all has to do with one's relationship to the body and to one's sexuality underneath it all.
Indeed, and those were changing things in for these dancers and for Americans in general at that time. Women were discovering different ways of dressing that was more relaxed. They took off their corsets. They didn't have to sit as still and as stiffly as they had been. So this idea of getting outside and moving in nature, finding natural means of expression in all of the arts contributed to the growth of modern dance, for example, and a new sense of freedom about it.
One of the things that is very interesting about this book to me is you talk about art and dance as both an outgrowth of European art and European dance, and then we as Americans really making our own things and creating our own art forms that are really different.
Yes, one of the underlying impulses in so much of American art has always been to try to answer the question, what is really American about American art? What's different about what we do here, the way we live our lives, our landscape, our approach to social things of all kinds? What's different from our European heritage? And attempts to try to define that. You know, in the early years, it was all about sort of cataloging and keeping track of objects and people and putting things down in an orderly, systematic way. And then later on, there were efforts to be more free and open about it.
One thing that's really super obvious, although sometimes you don't, it has to be pointed out to you to see it, is that one of the main differences between American and European art and dance is the African influence.
Indeed, that is so true. Because of our tragic heritage of slavery in this country, the presence of African Americans, their music and the dance that they brought gradually was filtered into the larger American experience, not only in the South, but then moving northward. There was the whole minstrelsy tradition that Americans of all kinds loved to watch and that had enfolded into it all kinds of terrible kinds of discrimination. But nonetheless kept alive these traditions, these rhythms, these lively dances and musical forms. Jazz, for example, is the obvious one that so influenced American culture in so many ways.
And it's such a, I mean, African dance, if you can generalize about it, is so earthy, whereas ballet is so kind of trying to be weightless. And the opposite natures of those two dances say a lot about the cultures that they come from and the way, again, of seeing oneself and one's body.
How true. Both in Native American dance and in African American dance, there was this sense of connectedness to the earth, of somehow belonging to it, of sensing rhythms that were there somewhere and trying to express that.
We're talking to art historian Sharon Udall. One of the dances that comes up quite often in art and in your book is the cakewalk.
Yes, which was part of that minstrel tradition. And as with a number of dances that come out of the 19th or even earlier century, and especially out of the African-American tradition, we don't know exactly how it got started. Some people say that it was done on plantations by slaves on their day off, sometimes mimicking their white masters, but it certainly went far beyond that to gain a place on the American stage and was a wonderful, lively, evolving art form.
And so what is the cakewalk?
Oh, boy. In some cases, there actually was a cake involved. It was a walk-around is what it was called, and it was a competitive couples dance in which each would perform and do this stage performance, and then at the end the winner took the cake. So hence the name the Cakewalk. But that wasn't always part of it. That kind of went by the wayside sometimes in the more theatrical performances.
Now, when we talk about minstrel shows and African-American dance, there was also a lot of white people doing blackface.
Yes, there was actually segregation in American theaters and on stages. African-Americans and whites were not allowed often to perform on the same stage or even in the same theater. So it became a process of using white actors, white dancers in blackface, and we know about some famous ones like Al Jolson, for example, but lots of predecessors of that. It's a very odd and interesting episode in American culture.
And that segregation, horrible as it was on many levels, had one kind of interesting benefit, which was that black theater, African-American theater and dance really evolved on their own.
They did. They were kept separate in those theaters and in that kind of performance so that the tradition and the styles were not watered down and not lost in the larger white American experience. So it did keep that tradition together.
Now, were both black and white artists representing black dance?
They were. There is a whole section in the book on African-American artists who were painting that whole experience, sometimes out of the minstrel tradition, but right up into the 20th century in the black clubs in Harlem, for example, and in Chicago, these well-trained African-American artists would view the dancers and attempt to put them down. And the greatest, perhaps the best known of the African-American dancers, of course, was Josephine Baker, who inspired
right.
dozens and dozens of white and African-American artists in France and in the United States to try to depict her radical, new, wild way of entertaining.
She was a truly free spirit.
Oh, she was indeed, and she was a very savvy one as well. She was very canny about publicity. She knew how to attract the attention of whites and blacks in her audiences, and she deliberately did things. This is when she was making her career in France, to tap into an idea about Africans as primitive, the word that was used in those days. So she paraded around the streets of Paris with her cheetah on a leash down the Champs-Élysées. She was quite something to be seen. She had all kinds of animals, and she behaved in a perfectly free and experimental way.
Which probably went over better in France than it would have if she tried to do it here.
No doubt, because she did come back to the United States and had performances here, but she never had the success in the United States. And I think it was kind of this residue of questioning, maybe of puritanical judgments on her behavior.
Which are still alive and well today.
They are. There are audiences that appreciate and that certain kinds of things and some kinds of dance and music, as we know, are still off limits to certain audiences.
Now, another thing that we see in your book is representation of dance scenes from different immigrant groups over the years. What, tell us about some of these and what they tell us about those people.
There was an attempt, I think, in every group to hold on to some of their own heritage, whether they were coming from Ireland or Italy, wherever they came from. One of the things that they cherished about where they had been in their growing up years was the celebrations that they had, and often dance was part of that. So when these people crossed the Atlantic, settled in New York or somewhere beyond, they remembered those things, and they brought them back to life in their social gatherings. There are wonderful photographs and paintings of girls dancing on the streets of New York on the Lower East Side, doing their Spieling dance, if they were German-American or Irish-American, just dancing seemingly for the pure joy of it, but also on the street hoping for a handout, a few pennies or a nickel flung here and there to buy them some food.
There's another thing that was so interesting, which is that dance, there were people who really made their living as dance instructors. And on the one hand, dance was considered a kind of genteel refinement. If you could dance, then you could become part of society in a certain way. And then on the other hand, it was a dangerous portal into unbridled sexuality.
Exactly. Because especially for young American women, a career on the stage was seen as the prelude to a life of prostitution often. So one of the worst fates that could await a young American girl was the idea of being lured, perhaps through dance, onto the stage, and after which she could never have a respectable life. And that was a long time in changing.
Now, there were also, as there are now, dance crazes, dance fads. One of them was the polka. Tell us about what this was like, probably earlier in our history than a lot of people would imagine. I mean, this preceded radio and all of that.
Yes, the polka, for example, crossed the Atlantic in the 1840s. And was danced by people first in immigrant groups and private parties and so on. But then it was picked up by a larger audience and observers, especially in New York, and then spread across the country. There was this polka craze. And it wasn't from only one place. It was from Central Europe, but a number of immigrant groups did it. It was lively. The music that accompanied it could be pretty simple, performed by just a couple of musicians. But the point was that it was fast, it was festive, it was a kind of kick up your heels and let go of all of your inhibitions for a few minutes.
And this is also represented in art quite beautifully.
Yes, yes.
Now, representing dance is so tricky. It isn't now because we have video and you can document and keep dance alive that way. But until then, people would have to either notate it or just make these paintings in hopes of preserving it. But I was thinking as I was looking at your book, we remember artists, but we don't remember dancers.
We don't. And some of that is their own choice. Some dancers didn't want to be represented by visual artists because they thought that nobody could ever quite capture them. It wouldn't be flattering. It wouldn't be characteristic in some way. But others of them, I'm thinking, for example, of the famous Russian ballerina Anna Pavlova, who came to this country and was here for a long time in the teens and 20s doing these long performance tours. She loved being photographed, and she invited working photographers to come to her studio or come to performances and capture that. And there were some fabulous photographs taken of her. Certain other artists were pretty suspicious, either about still photographs or especially about motion pictures. There's only one very brief film that has ever been recovered about Isadora Duncan dancing. She took pains not to have herself photographed.
Which is such a shame. Because, I mean, one of my favorite books ever is her autobiography. And you read it and you're just dying to see what she was actually doing.
Yes, we'd love to know more exactly how this looked when it was being performed. You can reconstruct it from still photographs to some extent and from some efforts at notation, but there's a lot that's been lost and that we can't fully recover. The reenactors of this kind of dance, and there are some good ones out there who try to imagine and perform the way Isadora Duncan did, and certainly Martha Graham is better preserved. But something is lost, and it would have been a better record had we had more film.
We're talking to art historian Sharon Udall about her book, Dance and American Art. Now, there are certainly some very well-known collaborations between dancers and artists, and dancers who inspired artists and who worked with them to do set design and other things. Tell us about some of these.
Oh, some of these were wonderful. Martha Graham worked for decades with the Japanese-American sculptor Isamu Noguchi, whose work is quite recognizable because he did abstract shapes and work that is in many museums on its own. But he and Martha Graham worked together for a long, starting in the 1930s. He did many stage sets for her, that seem to work very well with the kind of abstract movements that she was doing as a modern dancer and that her company did. So these are part of the important record of Martha Graham. She was very open to collaborating with all kinds of visual artists. Alexander Calder worked with her for a while, making moving sculptures that were seen on stage.
Was he inspired to do all those moving sculptures by dance?
By dance and by the circus to some extent. So right. He loved watching performances and trying to emulate that motion in some way.
Now, dance, as you discuss in the book, is not only an expression of our culture as it is, but it's an expression of who we'd like to be.
Yes, there is a lot of aspiration built into the art of dance and as it was represented. So I think it would be safe to say that thousands of Americans have looked at this kind of art, and little girls or little boys have been inspired to try to dance themselves or to try to do something that would be that transcendent. There's something about the idea of dance that can take you from where you are in an ordinary experience of the world and, however briefly, move you into some other space. There's a poem that I've used right in the beginning of the book by Rita Dove, who was the American Poet Laureate. It's called American Smooth, and the interesting thing about her is that not only is she an amazing poet, but she is also a competitive ballroom dancer. So she writes this poem about the experience of dancing with her partner, probably something simple like a foxtrot, but then getting caught up in the dance. And at the end, there's this sensation that for a moment, while they suspended disbelief, they were actually lifted off the floor and flying, and then only at the end brought down again to earth. But I think that's a metaphor for the kind of transcendent experience that's sometimes available in dance.
And there's also such a distinction between what's available to the dancer and what's available to the audience. Because watching dance is a beautiful thing, but doing it is even more fun.
Yes, and to those of us who experience dance more vicariously than any other way, there is that gap that we may never fully experience by not dancing before an audience. I think performers of all kinds have an amazing adrenaline effect and a will to perhaps surpass their own physical limitations briefly in the performance of a dance or a song, whatever it is they're doing. So there is this human kind of energy and will that is summoned in the act of dancing.
So where are we now in terms of dance and art in our very media-saturated world?
Media-saturated is the right way to frame the whole discussion, because there are so many different kinds of experiences of dance now available. And the crossover between performance artists and visual artists is virtually complete. Lots and lots of people who in decades past would have tried to make visual representations are now doing things themselves and then having that recorded and reproduced in some way, integrating all kinds of experiences electronically. The body and its physical capabilities are now kind of enmeshed in a much larger electronic experience of the world that characterizes all of visual art right now.
And of course, dance can be recorded and notated and learned from. I was talking to somebody who had a ballet company who said that the dancers always needed to see videos now. And he was saying, in our day, we didn't have videos. We had to learn from actually watching people. We never got a chance to watch ourselves. So it's a whole different dynamic.
It is, but ballet has always been more structured and more precise in a way than lots of kinds of modern dance. So there's an oral tradition or a practice tradition that has been handed down in dance studios by ballet instructors that was fairly similar, that was the same from one generation to the next. This has now opened up and it's not quite so precise and inheritable.
Very interesting. Sharon Udall is an art historian. She's author of the book Dance and American Art, A Long Embrace. And once again, you will be, Sharon, tonight at Collected Works Bookstore in conversation with former New York City ballet dancer Catherine Oppenheimer.
Right. Looking forward to that.
Very much so. Well, I want to thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And this segment, once again, we are talking about animals, specifically dogs. I'd like to introduce Donna Leshny of DuPaw's Rescue and Maureen O'Brien of Woof A Stay and Rick Dillander of A Fresh Perspective Dog Training. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Woof.
Let's start with you. Woof A Stay. That's like namaste.
Yes.
That comes from spiritual
perspective
on dogs.
It's Sanskrit, yes.
What do you do?
We're solely adoption, really. We take dogs from high kill shelters, and they are kenneled or they are with in foster, and we adopt them out every Saturday. We have a website, woofastay.com. I bark to the divine within you, so you know. And we do everything that's needed to get a dog adopted well, which is to give him or her someplace to be, a kennel or a home. Feed them well. Often they come in with medical situations and we take care of that. They're spayed and neutered in every shot you can think of, and they're microchipped. And right now we know the need of training, so we have some dogs in training so that they will be a good citizen when they go to their forever home.
So these high kill shelters, of which there are quite a number, unfortunately, in New Mexico, and we can't say it's their fault because there's just limited resources and all of that, but the dogs that you get, are they what some people might consider the problem dogs?
No. There's a time limit in a lot of these small areas, and it's simply a time limit and money and space. I get loads of small dogs that you wouldn't believe would be on death row. Chihuahuas, poodles, terriers.
Good heavens.
Yeah.
And is it pretty easy to place them?
There's no, for me at least, and I've been doing this for 8 years now, there is no equation. I have a great dog right now, Lakshmi, and Rick and Heather have tested her to be a service dog, and she passed with 5 golden paws. And she was adopted, and she came back. This is a wonderful dog, you know.
Yeah.
And then, as you can see from the pictures, I have Winky. He's a long-haired Chihuahua, 1 in 28. Come out long-haired, you can't breed them. You know, he was just walking the streets.
Good heavens.
So there's no equation to how fast they get adopted. Nothing. Nothing. Not even seasonal. Nothing.
Right. Yeah. How did you choose this work?
I didn't.
How did it choose you? What happened?
I was eating at a little restaurant in Pecos, and a baby pit bull came over to me, and he had been left behind from a drug bust, and I thought he was a baby. I didn't know pit bulls, you know, and I thought he was a tiny something, I don't know, something baldish, and I took him home to get adopted, and he was never adopted. He stayed with me. He was fabulous. So Ishmael sent me on this path, and then I went to teach I went to start a charter school of the arts in a very poor town, a very rough town, and I was jolted awake to the suffering of animals. I knew it, but it was in my head, but then it came down into my heart and through my body, and there was nothing I could do. It wasn't a conscious, oh gee, I'm going to do this. It wasn't. And then sort of like a vibration, the people of the town picked it up and started dropping dogs off in my art room. That was that.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, 7 pit bulls arrived at my home.
Good heavens.
In the country. And that was the end.
You must love pit bulls.
I love pit bulls.
And we're going to probably be dealing with some kerfuffle over pit bulls in the coming legislative session. They want to do breed-specific legislation. That's right. Well, we'll, I'm sure, talk about that more when the time comes. But let's talk for a moment about training. Mm-hmm. Rick, you do a fresh perspective dog training with your wife. What is the fresh perspective?
Well, there's quite a lot of fresh perspectives to what we do. What we do in our practice, essentially we have two primary focuses. We deal with behavioral rehabilitation for severe problems like aggression, neurotic fear, hyperactivity, destruction, that kind of stuff. And we take dogs out of shelters and place them with people with disability and train them as service animals. So we're dealing both with severe behavior and with very high-end levels of obedience training and socialization. The biggest thing about our approach to things that is different from other people's approach in terms of training is the biggest misconception there is about dogs, and frankly this really plays into the problems that rescues have, is that people tend to think of dogs as just a bundle of conditioned responses. And what they are is what they're always going to be, and what you get is what you get. And it's kind of like buying a car. Either you got a good one or you got a lemon, and that's kind of what people think. But that's not the reality of it. A dog is an intelligent, sensitive creature that is capable of communicating. They're capable of responding directly to you, and they're capable of changing their behaviors based on how they're treated, regardless of where they start, regardless of what problems they have to begin with. I have yet to find a dog that cannot be have whatever issues they came with straightened out and really put into even very high levels of training, like being able to work as a service animal for somebody who has high medical needs, that sort of thing. But this idea that there is no such thing as a broken dog, okay, that is really fundamental to our approach for dealing with dogs. And in every situation, it is really an issue of understanding what the dog's needs are, being able to fill them in a way that's adequate for the dog, and then everything that goes on with them settles out, regardless of where you start.
So give us an example. You get a dog in from, let's say, a shelter or rescue dog that has been abused. They've been hit. They're cowering. Mm-hmm. They have aggression issues. Where do you start?
Well, with something like that, you would have to start with trust building. Okay, because the thing is, in any situation, regardless of what's going on, a dog only cares about four things. There are only really four categories of things, and everything that will influence a dog's behavior falls into one of these categories, okay? They care about how you handle food, certainly. They care about social interactions, like your affection and your play and those sorts of things. They care about safety, and they care about social order, okay? The sense of living within a structure such as a family or a hierarchy. And for a dog like that, what you in any situation, you have to figure out of those four categories, where's a dog got the biggest need? So if I'm dealing with a dog who's been abused, I'm going to focus on safety first. I'm going to make the dog feel safe. I'm going to make them feel secure. I'm going to make them feel like they're handled in a gentle way. We're going to go through a lot of sort of work with them to deal with any fear issues they have about touch, about noises in their environment. And it's going to be about ramping down their anxiety first, then building trust with the family, then putting the kinds of structure in place that are necessary to socialize them to things outside of the house. And as long as you take a structured, orderly approach to it, anything can be addressed.
Now, what are the things that really make them feel safe?
Well, mostly what it boils down to is feeling like the authorities, the people who are supposed to be solving their problems, the family, are as aware of their problems as they are. And let me give you an example of a safety issue that is the sort of thing that most people wouldn't think of. In our house, we have six dogs, okay? And in general, I don't recommend six dogs for most families.
Right.
That's really just it. But in our pack, we've got a wide range of sizes. Our biggest dog is a big Rottie Bulldog who's about 95 pounds. I've got four of them that are in the 50 to 60 pound range, and I have a Pomeranian.
Yep.
Okay. They're a great little crew. But the problem is that the Pomeranian, because I got six dogs in a normal size house, he's always getting trampled and bumped and pushed. And when we open a door and all the dogs go charging out, he's spun in circles and he's, you know, he's doing all this kind of stuff. That's a safety issue. Okay, if he feels like he's going to get trampled everywhere he goes, if he feels like he's at risk of injury because there's just so much commotion going on in the house, that creates anxiety and it creates nervousness. And if I'm not aware of that and I'm not taking the steps that are necessary to make sure he doesn't get trampled and pushed and bumped and run over, he gets more and more and more nervous, which means then he becomes more and more barky. He starts being nippy. He starts spiraling out of control because he doesn't feel safe.
And so how do you make a little dog safe in a group of big dogs?
Well, in Frankly, I've got to just control how he moves around the others. If I open a door, he waits. All the other dogs go first. Then I bring him out after the kind of the rush has passed. I kind of set rules around him where I don't let the other dogs unintentionally bump him and step on him.
Right.
Just have to be aware of his need.
Now, doors are quite important. Whoever goes through a door first.
Well, that's a bit of an oversimplification. Okay, it really is. It is true in some contexts that who goes first matters, okay? But generally speaking, it's really more who has an attitude of owning the door. It's my door. If I tell you to go through first, you go through first.
Right.
And when you have a lot of dogs moving in a house, you're not going through every door before them every time.
Right.
It's just not going to happen. But if you have an attitude that says, you know, this is my house, I set the rules, that's my door, and everybody just go through it calmly, it sets the right tone. And it really gets over a lot of those, I have to go through the door first, I have to do this first. It's the kinds of structure and order that we find to be most beneficial with a dog. The idea of dominance and submission and all this kind of stuff that's very prevalent in our culture, we find that to be a little bit overbearing from the dog's point of view, the way most people try and do it, okay? Because most people tend to bring a sense of competition to the issue of being in charge. Okay, I'm going to go first. I'm going to do this first. I'm going to do that first.
Which kind of matches the competitive ideology of our country.
Well, yeah, but it's not what the dog needs.
Exactly.
You know, what a dog really needs, they do need a sense of structure and order and understanding that others solve their problems for them. But it really needs to feel more like a family, like parents and children, as opposed to boss and employee.
Right.
If that makes sense. There needs to be not only structure, but also nurturing. And if that sense of nurturing isn't present, the dog's needs are not going to get filled, and then no amount of I'm your boss is going to calm them down.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, so it's like the authoritative, loving parent.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But the parent who is aware of the child or the animal's needs cares for their needs as well as making sure that they're well-behaved and orderly and have manners.
Very, very interesting. Let's turn to Donna Leshny. Now, your group is called Dew Paws Rescue, D-E-W.
D-E-W, like dew on the grass, though we thought we were so clever until we realized that there was no such thing as a dew paw. It's a dew claw, but it's too late. We don't even incorporate it.
So what do you do?
Well, pretty much the same thing as Maureen and Karen and Wifestay. We take dogs out of high-kill shelters. We take dogs from community members. We try to work with community members to help them keep a dog at their home while we help them vet the dog, spay and neuter all the vaccinations, microchipping, deworming, debugging, the whole thing, and then provide a venue for people to bring dogs that need homes to adoption events in Santa Fe, El Dorado, Albuquerque. And I've also been doing it for, I think now, about 7 years. And I also sort of fell into it being compelled by a sort of an aha moment looking for a companion for my dog and seeing all these faces on, like on the websites going, wait a minute, who gets rid of a dog like this? Why is this dog there?
Yeah.
And then realizing that most municipalities in the state may have animal control, but they may not have animal humane support like we do, let's say, in Santa Fe and Albuquerque. And so dogs don't have any place to go after their whole time is up, and that's all legislated and very, 3 days or 5 days. These facilities are small. They're often part of the police department, and they're very tightly regulated. And so if a dog's whole time is up and that's it, there's no adopter, that dog can then be put down. And often, well, that's what happens. That's why euthanasia rate is so high, not only in the state but across the country.
And as Maureen was saying before, some of these are just great, cute, well-behaved, lovely dogs who for just no particular reason didn't get adopted in time.
And not only that, I think currently what we're seeing is an influx of animals being released to animal control and animal humane centers because of the current economic crisis. And so many, many rescue organizations are bursting at the seams with very lovely dogs who will do very well in any kind of a home. And often we're asked, well, how come you just don't work with, the large animal shelter in your area? No one organization can do everything. So this us small shop rescues are sort of like the spillover.
Right.
And
we give dogs more time. We're second chance rescues, which means if a dog may not present right away at a regulation shelter as a good candidate for adoption, that dog can come to DuPaw's Rescue and have 2, 3, 4, 7, 15 months to become a good dog for adoption. And with Rick and Heather's help of a Fresh Perspectives dog training, we've been able to turn around some dogs that are, you know, that were very challenging when we first got them.
What is it about the economic crisis? I mean, is it people literally can't afford to feed their dogs? Is it the vet bills? What is?
In some cases, it's that they can't afford to feed them. In some cases, they just can't afford the medical care. Honestly, in some cases, it seems that it's more a perception that they can't than any reality. The problem from the rescue's point of view is that when the economy takes a tank, the first thing that drops off is donations and support. But you have a lack of support and an influx of animals. And those two things together mean every rescue in the area is overloaded right now.
I found also the areas that I work in, it's definitely the economy now figures in, but it was always terrible in the poor town I worked in. There's a view that the animals are more like a possession. It's an old thought form, and we don't need this possession anymore. I'm really concerned about the living dogs and the condition, and so is Karen, the condition that they live in. You don't see it so much in Santa Fe. Certainly you can see it, but in the outlying towns you do see it. Chain dogs, no doghouse, no water, no food. I've known dogs, and I've rescued her, so don't panic out there in Radio Land, who she was chained in a yard. She did have a plywood doghouse. She was fed religiously once a week. Food was thrown over the wall.
Oh, no.
She had numerous litters of puppies. We got them all out for some miraculous reason and sent them to Colorado and finally got her out, and she lives a very happy life. She lived like that for 5 years
until
we could get her.
What kind of a dog was she?
A pit bull.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. And I'm going to change that word. Staffordshire Terrier, mm-hmm, or a
amen.
Staffy.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Pit bull's derogatory.
Well, on the animal shelter site, there's a lot of Staffordshire Terriers all of a sudden, yes, which seems like they're
pit bulls. Well, the problem is there's something like 22 breeds that are confused with pit bulls.
That's right.
Pretty much any flat-coated dog with a square head and a long nose this area is going to get called a pit bull. And so, frankly, it's not fair to the animals to mislabel them to something that's going to give them a lower chance of being adopted to begin with. But, I mean, it would be better to deal with the stereotype that pit bulls are dangerous, problematic animals to begin with. Because, frankly, up until the 50s and 60s, the pit bull was considered the all-American dog.
That's right.
Teddy Roosevelt had one in the White House.
But wasn't it called the nanny dog?
The nanny dog.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever watched The Little Rascals, mm-hmm, what do you think their dog with the little black spot on his eye? Petey, he's a pit bull, okay? There was an entirely different perception of the animal up until really just within the last couple of decades. And that doesn't mean the dog is different. It means the perception is different.
That's right.
And in unfortunately, though, that perception is there, and you're not doing dogs any favor by giving them that label they really don't absolutely have to have it, because it's not necessarily even accurate in many cases.
Well, you know, I have three small dogs, and each one of them has been attacked at one time or another in its life, either at a barbecue or in the dog park or whatever. And one of them was attacked and could have been killed by a pit bull. One by a chow and one by a terrier. Mm. And, you know, a terrier that wasn't even that big, but it was a vicious little cute thing. And we ended up at Smith Vet and, you know, all was well. But what's funny is that when your dog's been attacked by three different kinds of dogs, if you don't watch yourself, you focus on the pit bull attack.
That's right. Yeah.
That's right. It's the PR is all that. But if you think back, I'm old enough to remember when, mm-hmm, the Chow, the Rottweiler, the Doberman, and the Shepherd were the pit bulls.
Well, you remember when German Shepherds were, mm-hmm, the dog to be scared of.
That's right.
But what is the dog that's used for service animals these days? German Shepherds. Okay.
Right.
And the reality is it is really all about hype and media as much as anything. You know, the CDC keeps statistics on bites and that sort of thing. And a child is actually more likely in this country to get bit by a golden retriever, mm-hmm, than a pit bull. because people treat a golden retriever like it's an automatic nanny dog, and they treat a pit bull like it's a dangerous animal, which means the pit bull gets training, and it means the golden retriever gets left unattended with babies. And the reality is they're all just dogs, and they have the same instincts, the same response patterns, and they all need the same kind of guidance. And yeah, we, in our experience, I got to tell you, as a trainer dealing with aggressive dogs, I have been bit lots and lots and lots of times. I have never actually, in almost 10 years worth of dealing with aggressive animals, been bit by a pit bull.
Very interesting.
I have
been bit by all kinds of dog aggressive, not human aggressive. I mean, that's the stereotype.
It's the stereotype. But in my experience, breed really doesn't affect behavior in one way or another. It really is everything having to do with how they're trained, how they're raised, how they're socialized, just like a child.
Though there are some, I mean, there's a lot of having two Jack Russell Terriers, I can vouch for the fact that there's a lot of breed variation within
breeds. There is variation in the sense of what sorts of things they look to for work. So, for example, a husky is certainly bred to have a much higher drive to run and have endurance than, say, a boxer. Okay,
right.
But when it comes to what it takes for each dog to be calm, for each dog to be social, for each dog to be well-behaved, that is consistent dog to dog.
Right.
And there are certainly differences. Jack Russells are very high-energy animals. A Shih Tzu tends to be a low-energy animal. And that's because of what work they were bred to do originally. But that doesn't affect just what it takes for them to be good pets.
Exactly.
And can I just say one other thing? My association with the Fresh Perspectives and with all of my friends in rescue and our partners in rescue around the area, I think the most important thing that people need to hear is that I don't care how much you think you know about dogs, I don't care if you've been a dog owner all your life, there's always something new to learn. And if you have a dog or you have a dog with an issue, seek out training, seek out behavioral consultation. My journey has been literally eviscerating, thinking that, oh, I've been a dog owner all my life, I'm doing rescue, I know what I'm doing, my dog's like, oh no. I had tons to learn, and I learned something new with every dog, and having that guidance is so important.
And I didn't have the guidance, and I've made some terrible mistakes, and it's ripped my heart open, and maybe made me a better dog rescuer, but I would have rather snap to guidance before I did what I had to do. So.
Donna Leshny is with Dew Paws Rescue, Maureen O'Brien is with Woof a Stay, and Rick Dillander is with A Fresh Perspective Dog Training. And I will link to all of those on my website, SantaFeRadioCafe.org. Any other contact information you want to give before we go?
I have a needs list, if you don't mind.
Yes,
I have a needs list. It's really basically Karen and I and about three volunteers that come all the time. We need people to help us with adoption. I'm a grandmother. I'm a little grandmother. And so carrying the crates and the dogs is really hard for me. I also don't have adequate transportation. So every Saturday at 10:30, we need pickup people, and we need people to bring them back to the kennel. Okay.
And what's your phone number?
505-514-0181. And heartdropcomic@yahoo.com. Heartdropcomics with an X.
Okay.
Yeah.
I direct everybody for us to afreshperspectivedogtraining.com.
And you can contact me through petfinder.com, drop down for dog, and Santa Fe, New Mexico. We're usually the second one listed. We also desperately need volunteers and always need kibble food donation.
Ditto.
Donna, Maureen, and Rick, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you for having
us. Thank you. Woof a stay.